This is the Tom Bigby Tales, and I'm your host, Shannon Evans. I write about a small town in northeast Mississippi on the Tom Bigby River called Columbus, and sometimes I write about the rest of the state. This episode is about a woman named Caroline Seabury. Caroline Seabury was a young French teacher who arrived at the Columbus Female Institute from Brooklyn, New York, where she lived with her sister Martha, 11-year-old brother Channing, after the death of her father and siblings to tuberculosis, and to her mother to suicide over the loss of her children. Caroline was raised initially in Southbridge, Massachusetts, where her father was a widely respected physician. As a young woman with no dowry, no parents, and no suitable marriage prospects, Caroline set off for Mississippi after her parents' death to teach and live independently. She moved to Columbus in time for the new school term that began in October of 1854. She was 27 years old and needed to support herself. Teaching was one of the few professions available to a woman of station with no means, but with a good education. We have 9 years of Caroline's diary, beginning with her departure from New York in 1854 to her return home in summer of 1863. Her diary ends dramatically upon her first full day north. It went with her from New York to Minnesota after that period of time, where she moves to help her newly widowed, now adult, brother. Actually, she goes to join him before he marries the first time, initially. There in St. Paul, in a steamer trunk in the attic, would her diaries be found by her brother's descendants and would be donated with other family papers to the Minnesota Historical Society in 1955 and become part of the Channing Seabury and family papers. Caroline Russell Seabury was born June 1st of 1827 in Southbridge, Massachusetts. She was one of nine children, three from her father's first marriage. And by 1850, the father and all but three of his nine children were dead from consumption, or what we call today tuberculosis. After Caroline's younger sister died in April of 1850, her mother, deeply distraught, committed suicide the following July of that same year. And she was 46 years of age. Caroline, Martha, and her brother Channing, who was 11, moved to Brooklyn, New York, to live with their maternal uncle, Edwin Plimpton, and his wife, Mary. They remained close for the remainder of all their lives. Caroline, in 1854, would depart for Columbus to teach at the Columbus Female Institute. She was leaving behind a life of profound sorrow for a new adventure in a new land to her and a new school, a school for the daughters of the wealthy families of Columbus and the planters out in the prairie. Her boss, who would be the school's president, Reverend R.A. Means, and his wife and two children also lived at the college and met her to welcome her when she first arrived. She quickly recognized in the South that she was a non-privileged woman, especially considering that she was a female teacher and unmarried. Some of her early entries in 1855 tell of the shocking horrors of slavery she witnesses, beatings of a runaway slave, mothers and children separated and sold to resolve white owners' debts, etc. Recognizing that her bread and butter was paid for by the wealthy slave-owning parents, she quickly recognized that she would keep her northern opinions on slavery to herself and would remand them only to her diary. Her 16-year-old sister Martha would eventually join her in Columbus to teach, and then eventually to go further south in the state to teach at a school near Natchez. The two girls liked Columbus and made many friends and were quite happy there. By January of 1858, her sister had returned to Columbus from Natchez and showed signs of tuberculosis. She would be dead by June of that year. The Topps family, who built Rosedale, and was also William Topps, was a trustee at the Columbus Female Institute, donated a burial plot, number 13X, in the Oddfellows Cemetery, also known as Friendship Cemetery, for her beloved sister's final resting place. Caroline would spend the summers of 1859 and 1860 back in Vermont with her brother Channing and aunt and uncle. Each fall, she would return to Columbus to teach, leery of the rising winds of war, but she loved her new home, even though she feared the cost of war on both the North and the South if war were to occur. She writes to the election of Lincoln on April 16th of 1861. On April 17th of 1861, Caroline writes of the first shots fired at Fort Sumter in South Carolina. Sumter was attacked on April the 12th. The first shots were ordered fired by Columbus's own Stephen D. Lee, who would later become the president of Mississippi State University. By the 14th, Major Anderson of the U.S. Army surrendered the fort to his former West Point student, General Beauregard. Caroline struggles with her Northern sensibilities and her family's concern over her remaining in the South during this wartime, and worried if she does not leave now, she may be stuck, and even worse, considered a spy or a traitor, depending on which side she ended upon in the war. Knowing she would have no financial options and lose her independence if she did return to the North, Caroline opts to stay in Columbus and at her teaching position. She then begins to write about the early battles. After Bull Run, some battlefield trophies are sent home to Columbus. She spends her first summer of the war knitting for the boys, as they called it, in the circles of women formed to roll bandages and to knit socks and whatnot for the men. By October, she speaks of blockades preventing the local planters from getting their cotton to market. Talk of European military support of the South and Southern bravado are the talk of the town's male population, according to Caroline's journal entries. In winter of 1862, news comes of the fall of Fort Donelson and the surrender of Nashville. Many of Nashville's citizens have already escaped to Columbus and taken up with family and friends. Many of her local male friends were in the 14th Mississippi at Fort Donelson and were taken prisoner there. Two were killed. The horrors of war have come home. On February 22nd, 1862, Jefferson Davis is announced the president of the Confederacy. By April 1862, her writing turns to the battle 100 miles away near Corinth, the Battle of Shiloh. By April 10th, she writes of Columbus, which now must prepare quickly to be a hospital station for the sick and wounded of Shiloh. The battle ended 2 days prior, and the town had never thought it would be called upon. Caroline's journal entries are some of the most detailed known to exist of Columbus's citizen efforts during this war. During this part of the war, I'm going to read an excerpt. April 6th. Again, we hear of two great armies in battle at Shiloh, but little more than 100 miles from here, still fighting on Sunday, the day of battles. Our side completely victorious is the last dispatch, Generals Beauregard and Grant commanding. The suspense is heartrending. Who can lie down and sleep quietly while such awful scenes are being enacted so near to us? April 7th. The death of General Albert Sidney Johnston is just announced, and a more guarded account of our success. Tonight, there are many throbbing hearts, fearing that the worst is not known. April 10th. The truth has come. It was a retreat of the Confederate forces in good order, which ended the battle of 2 days, and we are told that Columbus must be the hospital station, as it is the safest point for the wounded and sick. The new hotel, our school building, the basements of all the churches are at once to be fitted up with cots for the men to be brought as soon as possible on the railroad. Not a preparation has been made of either sheets, bandages, or beds. All hearts, heads, and hands will be full of work for many a day. With the energy of woman's nature, when fully roused by distress, everybody is enlisted. April 14th. The intense heat of today and the exciting scenes with which the town is filled have left me exhausted, too much for sleep, but with no one to share my thoughts save my pen and paper. It is still outside. The moon has risen as calmly as though this earth was only smiling back her soft light. What far different sights we have just left. Agony in every conceivable form, and even worse than positive pain, the full apathy of hopeless sickness when all suffering is forever past and all hope. Crowded together in the new hotel were about 800, needing everything with the same clothes on in which they fought more than a week ago. Haggard, filthy beyond description, utterly repulsive, except this suffering humanity must excite our pity. A large proportion of them with vacant, expressionless faces, with wounds whose only dressing since the battle has been the blessed rains from heaven. Their hollow cheeks and glaring eyes, mutely asking relief. The good face of Dr. Eve was seen here and there, he trying to bring some order out of utter confusion. From the room devoted to surgical operations came shrieks and groans, some faint as from the lips of the dying, others from the strength of intense suffering. Up 3 flights of stairs to crowds of miserable objects lying along the sides of the walls, we went to the fever ward, which was filled to overflowing. As none of the building has been plastered, we could see through the different rooms, and who can ever forget it? The ladies were asked to distribute some nourishment, and how the poor wasted hands stretched out for it as we passed along. Some were too weak even for that and must be fed like children. Here was a mere boy grasping a piece of bread in the next cot, a gray-haired, withered old man with nothing but rags for clothing. His glassy eyes told too plainly that death had marked him. Not far along was a man of middle age, large frame, with hands which bore the marks of hard labor. He had battled with the world in times of peace and had conquered. War had taken him from home, and now wasting sickness had destroyed the strong man. His dying words, my friend could not understand. Knowing how often I had listened for the last whisper, she called me, telling him I could hear them. He roused all the strength left and whispered, "I want my body sent to my wife. I promised her. Tell her I am willing to go. My pay is due for 6 months. She'll need it. Will you write for me and tell her this?" His voice stopped in half an hour. He was in the dead room. I learned the address of his wife from another member of his company, and my promise has tonight been kept. We passed the bunk of one tall, black-eyed young man without speaking to him. He lay perfectly quiet, but the surgeon said, "There is one of the sickest men," and we turned back. He was a lieutenant in a Louisiana cavalry company, wasted to a skeleton, but retained the mark of a true gentleman in his wan face and his manner. I had a rose in my hand and involuntarily laid it on his pillow. He smiled and turned towards it. The nurse said he'd been talking about that morning early, about the sweet shrubs in his mother's yard, and wondering if they had come. I happened to have some in my pocket, handed them to him. He could only say, "Thank you, I love them." I told him he should have fresh ones every day. When we passed his place this evening, it was vacant. He lived only 6 hours after we saw him, but kept hold of the flowers, the nurse said, even in death. They found quite an amount of gold about his person, he told us. As the surgeon walked on with us, a light-haired, sunburnt boy of about 17 raised up and said, "Doctor, don't you know me? I'm so glad to see you." In vain, he tried to think who the boy was. At last, when told, he could hardly be made to believe it, that the son of his old friend was there. As he went on, he said, wiping tears from his eyes, "I have known that boy from a baby. His father is a wealthy planter, and he an only child. What would his poor mother say to see him now? I thank God no responsibility of this war rests on my shoulders." Just as we passed into one room, there lay one with the sheet over his face, waiting to be carried out. His companions around were talking as though no one of their number had just left, or any of them might soon follow. In one corner was one giving orders for battle, his eyes glaring wildly about. Now and then he would level an imaginary gun and exclaim, "There's one more Yankee gone." He had been 3 days and nights thus raving. No one knew him, and he had nothing by which he could be identified about his person. In the hurried retreat, companies had become divided. Many had straggled. The poor fellow screamed to Mrs. Long, "There, mother, I knew you would come and see me. There." Then the most violent exertions to come to her, but his feet were tied. Some poor mother may be grieving now for him, longing for some tidings of her dear boy, and he ere long will fill a grave over which will be placed on a plain board, unknown. A pretty little curly-headed drummer boy looked so wishfully at us. I asked the doctor about him. "He can't speak a word of English," was his reply. "He's a French boy from New Orleans." I said only, "Avez-vous, avez-vous une mère?" when he sprang up and commenced an autobiography at once. His mother was in France, had sent him to an uncle in New Orleans for a business education. He had run away. He was 15 years old, but very delicate. He would often repeat, and I would send him a pretty French story to read, and he would soon get better. His tears dried away soon, and he seemed quite happy as I say goodbye and au revoir. On April 28th, New Orleans fell to the beast, General Butler, who was harsh toward the inhabitants, male or female, young or old, and Caroline is disgusted even more by this. By July, Caroline discovers she was relieved of her teaching responsibility at the Institute in Columbus due to her being a Yankee, despite all she had done to serve the dying and the dead and the ill who had come from Shiloh. Colonel George Hampton Young, a trustee of the Institute and the owner of Waverly Plantation, hired her immediately to live at his mansion and be the teacher for his children. By January 4th of 1863, Caroline writes of Lincoln's January 1st Emancipation Proclamation, which is being read by locals and laughed at by how powerless they thought Lincoln was in enforcing the proclamation in the South. Caroline struggled with it all, knowing the Union meant business and the war will now only intensify. On April 24th of 1863, Yankees passed through West Point, Mississippi, just 10 miles from Waverly Mansion and less than 20 miles from Columbus. They took every fleet horse and chicken in their path. Caroline happened to be in Columbus visiting friends when this happened and was barricaded in with cotton bales across the streets of Columbus in case the Yankees wandered east across the Tombigbee River. She was stuck in Columbus for a week before she was allowed to return to Waverly. By the 4th of July of that year, Vicksburg, under a massive month-long siege, falls to General Grant. Caroline sees the writing on the wall. The South will lose this war. And if she's going home north, it's now or never. Caroline begins making plans to cross over enemy lines and return home to New York. Her diary is full of her plans and then of her journey. She begins her journey in a Conestoga wagon on July 29th of 1863, behind a team of mules led by a mule skinner and with a guard and guide, an Irishman named Dan Stone. They begin the slow, arduous task across East Mississippi, headed west toward Panola County, and then a little further to northwest, to finally boarding a tiny skiff on the Mississippi River to get Caroline and her trunks to Buck Island to await pickup by a Union ship. She's picked up eventually by the moderator and deposited in Union-held Memphis, Tennessee. She eventually boards another boat headed north along the Mississippi River to just above Cairo, Illinois, where she takes a train to Cincinnati, Ohio, to stay with a cousin for a week to rest up and knock some of the trail's dust from her. She goes on to New York and arrives at her aunt and uncle's place 1 month exactly after beginning her trip home, only to find that after escaping war, crossing through enemy lines, she has to get the key from a neighbor to get inside the only home she has at the moment because her aunt and uncle are at their summer place in Vermont. She reflects on the 3 years of war conditions in the South, and now that she's home, she feels like a stranger in her former home. And so she sits unsure of what's next. What was next for Caroline Seabury? Well, what we do know is by 1866, Caroline leaves New York and goes to St. Paul, Minnesota to live with her brother Channing, who's a bachelor. She cooks, keeps house and gardens, and does the bookkeeping for her brother's wholesale grocery business. She wrote letters to friends in Columbus, Mississippi, and her aunt and uncle in Brooklyn, New York, religiously. We know she lived with Channing at least until 1878, per the city directory. She apparently leaves St. Paul in 1780, per family legend, and returns to the South. But if it's Columbus, there's no 1880 census to consult and to confirm this. She does end up in Washington, D.C. in late 1892 and dies 5 months later on March 18th, today's date, in 1893. Her body is shipped from Washington, D.C. to St. Paul, Minnesota, where she is buried in the family plot in Oakland Cemetery. Caroline's diary gives us not only insight into life in Columbus as a woman from 1854 to 1863, it also shows how deeply divided her loyalties were for both the North and the South. It is an important narrative that shows, in its rawest forms, the Civil War South. While it is Caroline's Odyssey, it gives us a window into not just the everyday lives of women in pre-Civil War and Civil War South, but also an insightful examination of emerging women's independence and self-reliance taught in female seminaries and institutes across the nation that would be the precursor of women-only colleges and universities designed and led by women. It is women like Caroline Seabury who would set the standard at the Columbus Female Institute for what would eventually become the first state-sponsored women's university in the United States, the Industrial Institute and College, chartered in 1884 in Columbus, Mississippi, at what is today Mississippi University for Women. I want to thank you for being with me on Tom Bigby Tales today and tolerating my vocal fry. Thank you to Wisteria, Azalea, and Bartlett Pear Trees for the beauty of allergies. Thank you for joining me tonight, and I hope to see you soon. Good night.